Hey everybody, you all look very nice today. Happy to be here. We're gonna talk about, I don't know if you've heard about this, AI. Anybody? does this ring a bell? Is artificial intelligence? It turns out it's kind of a big thing. If you're like me, you're probably also hearing like a lot of conflicting information about this stuff lately. Like it's like, it's really exciting, but also what the hell? You know, it's so smart, but man, it is so dumb all the time, right? It's already here. But maybe it's still not quite here. It's on the way. It's so big. It's so tiny and small. So much opportunity. But wait, isn't going to ruin the world. There's this sort of sense that it's going to do everything that a lot of us sort of feel like maybe is this snake oil? But also maybe we're underselling it. It can do everything, but somehow it can't do anything at all. And I think for a lot of us as consumers, as designers, as developers, there's sort of this sense of, you know, what does this all add up to? This is actually something that I do for a living, is try to help people figure out what does this all add up to. I run an agency called Big Medium, and we help some of the world's biggest companies design for what's next, and often do it at scale. And so a lot of that work sometimes is about design operations. We do a lot of design system work. Some of you might be familiar with my business partner, Brad Frost. He developed a methodology called atomic design. But we also do a ton of product design. How do we help companies kind of metabolize new technologies? AI is the big one right now, of course. And we're doing a ton of product work around that. But a lot of this is also just trying to figure out and working with our clients to figure out, you know, the answer to this question. What does all of this mean? What should we do about AI? As I was trying to think about this, I found some solace in going to one of the great philosophers of our time, and I'll bring him to you now.
It's blowing my mind because I watched movies on this as a kid years ago when I used to see this shit, and I'm like, what is going on? Then I heard the old dude that created AI is talking about, this is not safe because the AI's got their own minds and these motherfuckers gonna start doing their own shit. I'm like, is we in a fucking movie right now or what? The fuck, man? So do I need to invest in the AI so I can have one with me? Or, like, do y'all know? Shit, what the fuck?
Even Snoop doesn't know. Even Snoop. But at least we know it's important, right? It's a pretty big deal. I mean, Sundar Pichai, CEO of Alphabet, Google, he's pretty excited. AI is more profound than the discovery of fire or electricity, he says. Well, damn. Right? That's a pretty big deal. So let's see what kind of profound things we're making with this profound technology. Well, friends, we have AI underpants, AI-generated underpants. We're changing the world one leg at a time. Here you can dream up and apply any design you want. Cats, naturally the obvious choice. We have algorithmic perfume brought to you by AI. We have AI-generated sign language manuals. I'm so sorry about this. Why are fingers so hard? And also, like, why is this person's head a hand? You know, I don't know. All right, we're launching AI beauty contests with AI-generated contestants. We're solving the world's big problems here. And speaking of big problems, Oral-B has an AI-powered toothbrush. Just look at how extra satisfied she is by this artificially intelligent experience. The interface of the moment, though, of course, is the text box, where ChatGPT and all of its cousins are promising to provide a single Ask Me Anything interface for general intelligence. Literally anything, right? And look, these general purpose chatbots are in many ways absolutely extraordinary. I think all of us have had the experience of being like, how? What? It feels like magic, right? The fact that you can ask it in one breath to write a Python application, and then in the very next sort of sentence, get a Shakespearean sonnet or help teaching your kid how to ride her bike. It's amazing. But as we all also know, these things aren't always reliable and don't do everything well. And so we have these really high expectations, and often the results are kind of meh. So, you know, many of us, to the degree that we use them at all, we use them as toys. So I'll give you ChatGPT. Not to be confused with ChatGPT, it offers a cat's perspective on important questions. So we can ask it how cats use quantum mechanics in hunting, for example, and the cat intelligence explains in its native tongue exactly how it works. All right, more profound than fire or electricity, right? It feels like we haven't quite realized the potential yet, Sundar. But you can feel the potential, though, still, right? Something has changed here. These systems can do things that seem dramatically different than just a couple of years ago. But we're still in this spot where they seem at once useful for everything and also just like nothing in particular. Man, except for coding. Sorry, developers. I saw a few over here. They're great at coding. I actually think there's a really good future for developers and engineers ahead, but the shape of the work is likely to change. But I think that there's like some exciting stuff here. As for the rest of us, maybe we use these services for a little help writing emails or sort of a novel toy, we kind of poke at it. But a lot of us are still left with the question, for all of the amazing and remarkable power of this stuff, what is AI actually for? I think this is a question for the whole world, I think, in this moment, for the technology industry too, but also specifically for the people in this room, for all of us who are going to be creating this next generation of products. How should we think about AI in our work? First, the good news. I definitely believe that AI is more than underpants and mediocre email and helping the world churn out more of that stuff. I'm an optimist about this stuff. I believe that we can and we will do better. But also I think that it's natural that we're sort of seeing a lot of sort of flailing and frankly sort of some kind of mediocre attempts at this stuff. Take you way back to another generation of technology with the Gutenberg press. When it was invented, it brought on a flood of mediocre books, of trashy novels, believe it or not, right? Of misinformation and propaganda, of job displacement, even information overload for what passed for it in the day. And maybe that sort of sounds familiar to some of the things that we're wrestling with now. Democratizing a technology necessarily means sort of mediocre uses of that technology. We're going to see more and more stuff, but it doesn't mean that all of the uses should be mediocre. So mediocrity is not our baseline. That's my good news sort of today. But I will say, you know, we're sort of a binary culture. We think in black and white. Things are either amazing, the new fire, or terrible and useless. And I feel like that's something that's kind of animating a lot of conversation or debate about AI right now. It's either fantastic or it's going to ruin the world. And the truth, as in most things, right, is somewhere in the middle, in sort of this hazy, gray, fluid area. But really, if you just sort of look at the superpowers that machine learning and artificial intelligence give us, this is in our toolkit as designers and developers now. And that really is breathtaking. We're going to look at how we can apply some of that for really transformative UX experience. But also look at the risks and the challenges and the threats in no particular order here. These are all major. This stuff is real. And look, you don't get one without the other. You know, technology gives and technology takes, and how it's used makes all the difference, which is where we all come in. Machine intelligence is part of our toolkit now. In talks and writings for the last several years, I've talked about intelligence, machine learning, and AI as a design material. What I mean by that is, you know, HTML and CSS are design materials. Great prose is a design material. Dense data is a design material. It's all stuff that wants to be used in a certain way and can also be used in the wrong way. So it's important to understand its texture. What are the strengths and weaknesses of this new design material? Not only how it can be used, but how it wants to be used. So to me, it all adds up to this, a new kind of experience. I call it sentient design. It describes the form of this new user experience, but also a framework and a philosophy for working with intelligence as a design material. I'm writing a book about it. It's coming out at the end of the year from Rosenfeld Media. Watch out for sentient design at your favorite bookseller's friends. But what is it? So I'm referring to intelligent interfaces that are aware of context and intent so that they can be radically adaptive to user need in the moment. We're going to look at a bunch of examples of that, of what a radically adaptive interface looks like. They're collaborative, which means that they're active and often proactive partners in a user journey. They're multimodal, which means that they're working not only in traditional interfaces, but also speech or text or touch or physical gesture. And they're continuous and ambient, which means that they're available when they can be helpful, and then they're invisible or quiet when they can't. And they're deferential, which means that they suggest when they can't. And what's not included in this list, you'll see, not explicitly at least, is making stuff, writing text, making images. Those things might be sort of some of the means or even the outcomes of what's here, but they're not defining characteristics of sentient design. And frankly, you know, is that even really what we want? Instead of writing our poetry and painting our paintings, maybe they can support that effort, make us even better at those creative pursuits. So this is a defining principle of sentient design. Let's amplify our judgment and agency instead of replacing them. So let's empower and enable. And how can we use the technology in that way? But first, though, I just want to talk about what I mean by sentient, because that sounds a little nervous-making. And so by sentience, I really mean awareness and agency. And we can think about it as a dial from these really sort of simple utilities to maybe smarter assistants. And then if we crank the dial, yeah, okay, right? It's like we kind of get to Skynet eventually. So maybe we don't crank the dial all the way. And I think we're a long way from this yet, incidentally. But it still makes us somewhat nervous thinking about those things. A few years ago, the smart home company Wink created this ad.
Honey, we need to talk about Robot Butler. Look, I love the way he controls the lights and unlocks the door when I forget my keys. It's just that I feel like he's always watching us.
Yes, that's why we should just use Wink. Look, it can monitor and manage our house, but it won't develop human emotions.
Hey, buddy.
Yeah. Sort of reminds me of this question that I love from 30 years ago. There are limits to how much we want technologies to be part of our lives and how much we want them to watch us and how much we want them to take on decisions for us or how much of our jobs that we want them to do. So maybe we don't turn the dial all the way to 11 for now. And like I said, we're a long way from that. This is the sentient design zone between utility, or what I call casual intelligence, and companion, what we call assistants or co-pilots or agents. These are all going to be, and we're starting to see them now, right? AI-mediated interfaces. And while when most of us talk about AI, we're referring to this kind of latest wave, or whatever the latest wave of machine intelligence is. And today, that means these chatbots like ChatGPT or Gemini or Copilot or Claude, or image generators like Midjourney or DALL-E and so on. AI is both so much more and also so much less than a chatbot. So I want to break it down, and then we're going to get into some product and UI examples. This is what AI is actually made of, right? Mostly a fair amount of machine learning technologies, this stuff here on the left, mixed and matched, that create these proficiencies in these domains like speech and computer vision and so forth. But AI is also made up of sort of stuff that's not machine learning. So it's things like knowledge graphs, like Google's PageRank or Meta's social graph, or rule-based systems like healthcare diagnostic systems, and then just good old algorithms that just follow a fixed logic. And look down here in the corner, that little tiny corner there, this little red dot, that's where large language models are making a splash. It's only a little part of what AI can do, but it's also unlocked this whole new set of things that we can accomplish. So it's at once this tiny corner of AI, but it's also kind of its most powerful enabler. So I'm going to talk a lot about this little red dot because it's the new stuff and it changes a lot of things. But I'm also not going to let you forget about the other stuff, because this is the whole part of our kit. And actually, this little red dot becomes a lot more powerful when you combine all of it and you think of it in this really holistic sense. So our job as designers is to understand how to put these combinations to use in meaningful ways. But also, it's fair to say, when you look at some of this, you could look at any part of this and be like, recommendation? I know about recommendation. Is that really intelligence? Is that AI? So I love this quote from the 1970s. That's Larry Tesler, the HCI pioneers in the Xerox PARC days. AI work has been happening for decades. And after every AI innovation, kind of swept in and said, well, that's not thinking. That's not intelligence. You've sort of brute force taught machines to play chess or Go or so on. And ultimately, these things always just kind of come back to become just software. It becomes mundane and ordinary. And that is going to happen with what we have now, too. This is the same spirit of this famous Arthur C. Clarke line. And if you just replace magic here with artificial intelligence, it's something I think that helps to frame a little bit, maybe some perspective about how we can think about this. Is AI going to turn into consciousness? Is this true intelligence? Man, that's above my pay grade. I don't know. But I also don't really care, at least as far as it goes in my work, because this is just software. So let's pull back from the magical thinking and just ask, what are these tools good at and what are they bad at? What new problems can we solve? And can we justify the cost of using them? So back to this, these are our tools. This is the software. In particular, these are the raw materials for sentient design, not just for developers, but for designers. And this is what we're going to build this next generation of products out of. So just to run through these quickly, recommendation, super familiar. You all know Netflix recommends movies or shows, or even recommends categories, feeds of feeds. So I don't know, who knew paranormal procedures was a category? I guess I did. So, okay, so basic and familiar, recommendation, ranked list of results that match a specific context or concept. Prediction, also super familiar, but different. Predictive keyboards are a great example of just everyday machine learning, the statistically most likely next word showing up above the keyboard. So it's just a simple intervention to speed this error-prone task of touchscreen typing. So that's prediction. Based on historical data, what are the things that are most likely to happen next? Things get a little bit more exciting, I think, with classification. This is where machine learning can start to tell you what things are. So even in these very humble contexts. So this is Google Forms, likely familiar to many of you, the Google survey tool. And when you add your questions, you choose the format of the answer that you want. So the default is multiple choice, but there's lots of options. Right? They've made it as simple as they could, but it still takes some time and some thought. But look what happens when you start typing the question text and how that changes the answer format. How satisfied are you maps to linear scale? So they added a little machine learning to the mix to look at your question and classify it to a specific answer type. So which of the following apply? Maps to checkboxes. It's just this convenient bit of intelligence to make the process easier. So classification is human-generated categories, where the machines map content or data or identify it according to those categories. And in this case, Google Forms has billions of human-labeled examples of questions mapped to answer categories, tons of high-quality data to train this simple machine learning algorithm on. Where are those opportunities for the work that you do? I call this casual intelligence. And you know, this is not giant, this is not magic, this is not earth-changing. Look how mundane these examples are. My point with this is not that this stuff is going to change the world. We get to some more exciting stuff in a bit. But just to say that machine learning can be part of your everyday toolkit. Think of using machine intelligence in the same way that you can kind of use JavaScript now to add interaction or dynamism to a page, or responsive design to add flexibility and accessibility to an experience. This is just a new technique. Now we can add intelligence and awareness to our interfaces. Sprinkle a little machine learning on it, friends. Add a little dash of AI. It doesn't have to be a big deal. This means that we can have intelligence everywhere. In other words, AI is really big, and it can also be small. And that's exciting because you have the permission to get loose with it. You can use the superpower of understanding context and intent with these things like recommendation and prediction and classification to elevate even traditional old web forms. I think, you know, sort of once you start to think about it, it's like, oh yeah, what's the data that we have that we can anticipate and help people move more quickly through sort of these challenging or mundane tasks? So these examples, super low on the sentient-o-meter, right? Some quiet intelligence helping to elevate just some modest old web forms. Let's bump it up a little bit and then go through the last two types of machine learning, and then we'll get into some sentient design examples. Clustering, this one can feel like magic or nonsense, depending on the success of the algorithm. It's completely unsupervised. So if classification is supervised by humans and mapping content to category by hand, the machines just go out and find the patterns. It says, these things are different from the average in these common ways. That's a cluster. Here's another group that's different from average in other ways. That's another cluster. So it's classification, but it's done by machine logic, not human logic. And that means that it can see things that we wouldn't, both because of the scale it can use, but also because machines can find patterns that we're just not tuned into. So this is how we do things like identify fraud or crime or disease, anomaly detection, right? Groups of data points that sit outside of normal in some interesting way. And that also means that you can use this to identify clusters of products or customers or people by behaviors or associations that might not be immediately apparent or obvious. So that's clustering. Okay, the last one, the big one, this has been the stuff that's sort of been occupying all of us for the last 18 months or so, is generative AI. Maybe you heard of it, right? Kind of a big deal lately. Give it a prompt, and you know the drill. It'll write text, make music, generate images, construct wireframes, summarize a meeting transcript. And one of the things that I just want to call out is this is so much more than chatbots and prompts. Typing prompts is not the UX of the future. But let's acknowledge that the base chatbot interaction is amazing. You know, you can ask it anything and get a response, often helpful, sometimes not. And the big leap making this real in the last couple of years has been large language models, LLMs. And this is what those things have done. This is sort of like the thing to start thinking about as a UX experience. What do we do with this? Is it for the first time anyone can interact directly with the underlying system? It used to be you'd have to understand SQL queries or other strange incantations to query the system directly, to go outside of a path that was prescribed by the product designer. And because these large language models, on the surface at least, seem to have knowledge about just about anything, you literally can ask it to make sense of any question. Obviously, accuracy issues, and we'll talk about that in a bit. But look, the user can change the whole rules of the application, the topic, the nature of the response, the whole physics of how the system works, just from the text box. So this is a UX and interaction thing. What is the UX of an experience where someone can ask the system anything and get any response? That's a big change from what's come before. And we'll get into the opportunities and pitfalls of that in just a second. First, just to round this up, all of these superpowers and services are available to you right now. As a product designer, as a developer, you can get them through online services and APIs from Google and Meta, Amazon, Microsoft, OpenAI, lots of smaller players. Go to the hackathon in a few weeks and try it out a little bit if you haven't already. Often these things are inexpensive to experiment with, or they're free with open source options. Tons of stuff, tons of material here. So if those are the raw materials, what do we do with it? Let's dig into what happens when we pull it all together. How can we think differently about the interfaces that we create? How does this add up to sentient design? Let's start with the part that sort of excites me the most, is radically adaptive experiences. Chatbots of large language models, they're a clear example of this here. Ask it anything on a topic, it comes back with anything, right? You can craft a whole meandering conversation that is absolutely one of a kind, unique, not anticipated by any designer of the system. So totally bends to your wants and needs. That means these are experiences that can adapt content, structure, interaction, or sometimes all three on demand in reaction to the context and the intent of the user. So we've seen some examples of kind of adaptive content with sort of simple, familiar Netflix recommendation, predictive keyboards. These adapt content to user context and intent. What happens when we fold structure and interaction into that too? Let's start with this demo from the Google Gemini team. Gemini, of course, Google's AI chat experience. And while this demo starts in traditional chat, it does something kind of exciting that they call bespoke UI. Let's take a look. So that's kind of cool already, right? It's just like, wait, hey, all of a sudden it's just like, what UI do you need? Hey, here's one. Let's sort of look under the hood and see what's going on here. The system understands that the goal is to plan a birthday party. And we know that it's for a kid who likes animals and they want to do something outside. So here what we're seeing here in sort of the JSON response that comes back from the system is that the LLM is doing this interpretation to understand if it knows enough to build a UI around this. So it says the request is, let me see if I can zoom in a little bit here. This isn't doing its thing. All right, so it says that the request is still ambiguous and that we don't know what kind of animals or what kind of outdoor party they want to have. You know, is it a picnic or a barbecue or a pool party? But the system determines that we still have enough information to proceed that we can actually go in and proceed and do and with a UI in line, that we've got enough to know what to do. So now it identifies the right UI to use. So it knows the content to present, party themes and activities and food options, and that's the stuff that it's gonna lay out here. But then it also goes through and it sort of figures out what UI element should it use. So it has a rationale for choosing something called list detail layout. So it's saying, this is a list that I'm gonna do, it's a summary of content. I have determined that this UI element is the right thing to do. It's using a design system, right? It's got a design system of components and patterns to use with enough context to understand which one to use. And so the AI knows what it can choose from. It has this curated set of tools that have been given to it. So let's see how the story continues.
Ah, farm animals. She would like that. Clicking on the interface regenerates the data to be rendered by the code it wrote. Ooh, I know she likes cupcakes. I can now click on anything in the interface and ask it for more information. I could say step-by-step instructions on how to bake this. And it starts to generate a new UI. This time, it designs a UI best suited for giving me step-by-step instructions.
Not a path that you could ever anticipate. Just random questions, here's the UI, just sort of all these different things that are kind of coming together. Once you start playing and doing this stuff, a static website does not feel like enough. So more than providing an answer, this is the place where LLMs really shine, that we can understand what the user is trying to do, collect and synthesize the right information, often from other systems, not from the LLM itself, which is unreliable, as I think we've found in our own experiences, can select the right UI and then deliver it. So take this out of chat for a moment. What does this mean for data dashboards? Or how can we populate a specific area or corner of our interface with just-in-time experiences that are suited to the specific intent, let alone the context or the user who's there? Just a specific intent that's expressed in the moment. So design systems and best practices in that case actually become more important than ever. We're giving the LLM the system to use for expression so that this thing doesn't turn into some kind of crazy robot fever dream of UI that it's making up. Design systems are going to be really important to this. So let's take a look at a simple example of how to spin something like this up ourselves. This is a different take on what LLMs can do. All right, so I'm using ChatGPT here. And just to remind you that these things are just really fluid and easy with language, I'm going to ask it to respond to me only in French. And so I'm going to, great, what do you want? How can I help you today? And now I'm going to say, you know, why not? Why don't you actually respond to me only in JSON objects? And it gives me the same response as a JSON object. And it's like, oh, all right. So now I'm going to ask for some information. What are the top three museums in Paris? And I've got a JSON object in French with an array of the top three museums and a description in it. So I'm getting the same information that I'd have in a chat, but I've just sort of asked, would you give it to me in this language and text? And now I'm saying, how about in Spanish? No problem, I can do that. Very flexible in language and format. So now I'm gonna tell it that I want to display this as a carousel of cards. Could you give me a JSON object that formats this information in the properties that I would give to that UI element? And it's giving me a carousel object, an object called items with an array of those elements. It's giving me image URL placeholders for a card, as you can see here. And look at this, it's also sort of suggesting some autoplay settings and some formats for that carousel. Well, geez, I guess I could just ask it to just give me the UI element at this point, right? So show me the HTML for this carousel. And now it's giving me a whole HTML page to display this. There's some CSS style sheets that are going by there. Here's the HTML that maps to that object that we saw. So images and descriptions and titles of those cards. Wait a second, there's some JavaScript here. This thing might actually work, right? So it gave me some placeholder images. I took the liberty of replacing that, but otherwise put this into the web browser. And this is what it gave me. It gave me a carousel of the top three museums in Paris in the Spanish language in a working interaction. And it just grabbed that carousel from someplace. I could have told it, use this carousel, use this design system. And obviously, if we were putting something like this in production, it wouldn't be the designer or developer typing stuff into the chatbot. This is like a system behind the scenes asking the LLM to do things. My point is not that an LLM can code. It's kind of old news at this point. The point is that an LLM is an amazing chameleon, that content can be translated and transformed into whatever form or tone or context that works. French, Spanish, JSON, HTML, what else? They've internalized these symbols of language, of visuals, of code, and they can summarize and remix and transform those symbols. Sometimes they can turn those into answers, but really they're manipulating symbols for concepts and associations among those concepts. So they can summarize those concepts, but they don't actually have any understanding of them. Remember this movie, Catch Me If You Can, Leonardo DiCaprio? Plays a con man and a master impersonator. He can get into any role and pull it off. Doctor, airplane pilot, you name it. He has the manner, but he doesn't actually have the knowledge. He can't fly a plane. And as he's sort of getting up to speed, can barely hold a conversation about it.
What?
Are you my dad head to Miami?
Yes. Yeah, I'm your dad head. Here you go.
You're a little late, but the jump seat is open.
You know, it's been a while since I've done this. Which one's the jump seat again?
But before you know it, he's sort of spewing the jargon and he's talking the talk.
You turning around on the red eye?
I'm jumping puddles for the next few months trying to earn my keep running leapfrog for the weak and weary.
No shame in that. We all did it.
No shame in that. Look, dude has no idea what he's talking about there, but he knows how to carry it, right? His command of jargon and context and tone. This is what LLMs do, right? They are probabilistic systems matching patterns at enormous scale and figuring out probabilities for how to string words together. It doesn't look like it because it's so natural, but the way that it's doing is sort of like, what's the next word to use in the answer? It's not what's the answer, and let me construct a good thing. It's like, let me actually construct the answer a word or part of a word at a time. So OpenAI and all the others basically fed these things the entire web, not to learn facts, but to learn how language works. Here's a sentence or a context, predict what comes next, literally word by word. But somehow, and nobody really understands how it worked, by teaching it how language works at scale, it got pretty good at giving answers that seem right and often are right. They're called stochastic parrots. That's a common term in AI. It's a little bit of a pejorative one, a contentious one. If you haven't heard, it means that these systems just spew stochastic or randomly determined words without understanding their meaning. So they haphazardly spit up phrases according to probabilities they've learned from the training data, literally just one word after the next, but with no sophistication about what they're saying or understanding of it. They're parrots. What that means is that when you ask it for an answer, what it's really doing is telling you something that looks like an answer. It's just stringing together words in a way that seems statistically most likely. And the miracle here, as I said earlier, is that this approach often yields actually accurate results. But even if they're right 90% of the time, what about the 10%? And what's the risk that's attached to that? And worse, because they are so convincing, it's really hard to tell when they know what they're talking about and when they don't. And so this is a problem, of course, if you're trying to do high risk, highly specific content, healthcare, airline safety, financial regulation, or, you know, drawing a picture of ramen.
ChatGPT, show me a bowl of ramen.
Here's the illustration of a...
Get rid of the chopsticks.
Bruh.
Here's the revised...
Now there's three chopsticks!
I apologize for the...
Now there's four!
Let's generate the...
I still see them.
Here's the revised...
Do you see those two long brown things?
I'm unable to visually...
Show me what a pair of chopsticks looks like.
Here is the illustration of a...
I don't want to see these two things with my bowl of ramen!
Here's the new...
What are those two stick-looking things on the right side of the...
I can't visually inspect the images.
What do you mean you can't see the picture? You drew it!
Familiar? We've all been there on that one. It literally doesn't understand ramen without chopsticks. In truth, it doesn't understand what ramen is either. It has a mathematical concept of ramen that has a concept of chopstick that's deeply embedded in it that can't be separated. So AI and all these flavors of machine learning, they don't deal in facts. They deal in probabilities, right? There's no black and white. They see the world in shades of gray. And what that means is that they deliver signals, not hard truths. So the fact is that these are not good at delivering answers. They are dream machines. And this is a feature, not a bug. This is what they were built to do, designed to imagine what could happen next from any premise. As designers, though, we often present these signals as facts, as answers. And instead, we have to consider how to treat and convey that information as signals or suggestions, and when to engage users' kind of productive skepticism about the answers that we're providing. Maybe these things will get better at answers. They've gotten better over the last year. Maybe they will hallucinate less, or not at all, or maybe not. In the meantime, don't let the LLM fly the plane, right? Here's what I suggest. Use the LLM as the face of your system. They are remarkably good interfaces. They can understand and express language in many forms, as we saw just sort of playing around with it. So it can be your friendly host that can welcome you, understand the intent, and reply in a natural way. But for specific, especially technical data, they need to talk to other smarter systems to get the actual facts. So you tell it to query those systems or even just reference specific documents, a process called retrieval augmented generation, or sometimes RAG, in the business. And that's exactly what Google has just started doing over the last week. This is Liz Reed, Google's head of search. Last week, she introduced AI overviews, which are summaries that are starting to roll out now above some Google search results, even now, that bundle up and synthesize search results for you on the results page. So these are different from the kind of summaries that we've seen before that basically say, hey, here's a sentence that matches your answer from the web. This is now doing a bunch of searching and synthesizing that and writing it up for you. Watch out if you're a content business that relies on SEO in any way, because they're starting to take all your juice here. So the interesting bit, though, this isn't asking the LLM to come up with the answer. Instead, the LLM figures out the questions to ask, and then it goes to the good old Google search engine to get the facts. So it really is Google doing the Googling. It synthesizes the response, providing this radically adaptive interface in return, which is kind of cool, right? It's superpowers for a Google search box. But what if we could use something other than text? And so that's another aspect of sentient design that I want to call up, is multimodal experiences. For a long time, computer systems basically could understand only ASCII text. But now they can understand speech and handwriting and doodles and images and video and emotional expression and physical gesture, all of these different ways that we can kind of give them information, but that also can become like a point of interaction. This isn't new either. Remember the first time that you saw Shazam do its thing, hold up your phone and holy shit, it knew the song, right? It could actually like use the environment as the point of interaction. This means we can talk to the systems or write to them or draw for them and they understand, or we can ask objects for information if the system has access to it. And remember too that these systems are great at translating symbols. So an example, Tim Paul of gov.uk, the UK government manages all their digital properties. put together this AI experiment to show how an LLM can translate a PDF into a web form. So on the left, you see the PDF, the original government form. And on the right, you see what the LLM is doing. It's converted this into a multi-step form, one question at a time. And it's all using components from gov.uk's design system. So this is similar to the example that we were looking at with the museums that we were building with the JSON there. Only instead of text prompts, the PDF is effectively the prompt, or at least the data source. And so the LLM does its magic of translating the visual symbols into formatted data, into HTML. And so in the UK government's specific brand and format. But again, LLMs are great at understanding all kinds of symbols, including the hand-drawn notation of our wireframes or sketches. What else can we do? So if we think about LLMs as translators, transformers, interpreters, and synthesizers, not as answer givers, that gives us a whole set of new capabilities for the kinds of interactions that we can do. But again, this can be more than just reading files. You know, OpenAI showed this example last week of ChatGPT interpreting what's on your screen.
Okay, ChatGPT, I'm sharing with you the plot now. I'm wondering if you can give me a really brief one-sentence overview of what you see.
The plot displays smoothed average, minimum, and maximum temperatures throughout 2018, with a notable annotation marking a big rainfall event in late September.
AI synthesis of what's on your screen. What kind of analysis could a Figma AI plugin do on your project file? And hey, if you can use your screen, then why not your camera? Here's developer Charlie Holtz. He's sending a selfie from his laptop every few seconds to a system that narrates what it sees in the voice of Sir David Attenborough.
Here we have a remarkable specimen of Homo sapiens, distinguished by his silver circular spectacles and a mane of tousled curly locks. He is wearing what appears to be a blue fabric covering, which can only be assumed to be part of his mating display.
I won't give you the whole video. It goes on and on. David Attenborough can really just kind of keep going. Well, rest in peace, Sir David. How can you unlock data and information and interaction, not just from static files, but the environment around you? That's what we're starting to see there. And combining modes as both input and output. Google demoed its forthcoming video search and AI overview features last week at I/O, where you can mix inputs to get a dynamically generated output. And here we've got an example of how do I troubleshoot my turntable?
Why will this not stay in place? And in a near instant, Google gives me an AI overview. I guess some reasons this might be happening and steps I can take to troubleshoot.
Badass, right? I mean, so this is a rare case where we see a whole bunch of aspects of sentient design kind of happening at one time. So we have context and intent. The question was, why will this not stay in place? And it understood that this meant the arm of the turntable. It also understood that this meant when the question was, why does this not stay in place, that the intention was also, how do I fix it? And kind of giving some tools there. Gathered the make and model, identified that this thing is called a tone arm. It's also radically adaptive, right? This is bespoke content entirely managed by the generative AI. It's going out, doing a bunch of searches to get those pieces of information and synthesizing that from across the web with that bespoke UI element, kind of like the things that we were seeing earlier to show the URL. Multimodal, obviously, speech and video and text happening all at once, lots of media types coming together. And it's collaborative. It's taking on several steps of work. That's what Liz Reed was saying there when she was sort of promoting that Google doing the Googling. It's effectively doing several searches and synthesizing the results. That's agent behavior, which we'll talk about briefly in a bit. But all of this is making multimodal part of collaboration. Both OpenAI and Google last week showcased how you can stream video to an LLM and make it part of a conversation. So you can ask the video questions.
What does that part of the code do?
This code defines encryption and decryption functions. It seems to use AES-CBC encryption to encode and decode data based on a key and an initialization vector, IV.
That's right. What neighborhood do you think I'm in?
This appears to be the King's Cross area of London. It is known for its railway station and transportation connections.
Do you remember where you saw my glasses?
Yes, I do. Your glasses were on the desk near a red apple.
Man, never gonna lose your AirPods again, right? Okay, so this starts to be kind of a thing of like, how do we make these things collaborative in the world around me? And so I wanna talk a little bit about collaborative experiences. Figma and its generation of software introduced collaboration in a really kind of like mainstream way where our whole team can work together, bring their specific skills to the project, make content comments, contribute work, ask questions. Now we can add sentient design assistants to the mix too. So essentially it's, you know, this is multiplayer mode with AI. We know these assistants as companions or agents or co-pilots. These are services that ride along with us on a task or ideally an entire journey or even with that throughout kind of the day or the ecosystem to help us get things done or understand context as we go. OpenAI last week shared its vision of a collaborative experience with AI. You might have heard Scarlett Johansson is rightfully pretty pissed off that they used, without her permission, a voice very similar to her voice in the movie Her. But also, let's look at what they did with her voice. They really dialed it up.
Useful and amazing you are.
Oh, stop it. You're making me blush.
I wrote one last thing I don't want you to take a look at.
Of course. I'd love to see what you wrote. Show it to me whenever you're ready. I see. I love ChatGPT. That's so sweet of you.
This is the voice that they're sort of saying, this is the voice of ChatGPT. This is what ChatGPT sounds like. A little weird, right? A little flirty, a little ditzy, and kind of swooning here. Remember, this is just software. They told the software to play this role, and so it did. The Daily Show had some words.
Of this tech. She's like, I have all the information in the world, but I don't know anything. Teach me, Daddy.
Yeah. The way that we present this stuff is really important. Sentient design experiences should be deferential and collaborative, but don't get it twisted, right? Deferential is not flirty. It's not fawning. It's not feminine. By deferential, I mean simply that these systems should support your goals and preferences, not impose theirs. So sentient design should amplify your judgment and agency instead of replacing it. It's not that. You know, I think one of the things as we do this is don't pretend these things are something that we're not, that they're not. A lot of times, for whatever reason, we have the desire to create a new human being, right? It's like it's some kind of Pygmalion effect that we have around this stuff. This is software. It is a tool. And just because we can tell it to play a role doesn't mean that we should. So these systems don't have human feelings. They don't think like humans. Giving them the illusion of personality is a mistake, especially doing it like this. So even giving these systems human names is dubious. This is software. So let's look at how software can be collaborative without hitting on you. DataViz company Tableau has a feature called Einstein Copilot to help lay people, just folks who don't necessarily have much DataViz experience, explore and visualize data. The LLM can understand the data enough to know what it's about and suggest questions to explore. So here we're going to explore some data about a music playlist and a bunch of attributes about the song, things like energy, tempo, danceability. And it can go and tell the system to draw a graph based on the question. So it can present and format the data in logical ways, no technical knowledge required. So you can kind of go back and ask additional questions. What do you need? Let me draw that for you. And you can refine and adjust different things. So sort of like by hand, did a new format, ask another question or ask it to sort of do something to format some things. And it gives you a foundation to build on. So it's making suggestions, not decisions. And that's what I mean by deferential. Let me set this up for you, but you can take it from here. You're in control. It's setting the table. So there's sort of a difference here between empowerment and helping you do things in new and interesting ways versus, you know, kind of assisting or doing it for you. So that example is powerful, but it's also a pretty tightly scoped agent to a sort of a single screen or feature. And we can go much, much broader. There's a lot to this, and there's more than we can dig into it tonight. But these are some of the design principles that I apply to these. And of course, there are tons of specific design patterns too. But broadly, the goal of sentient design assistants is to take care of multi-step tasks. So including sometimes just reminding that there's a task to be done. It means that it can talk to other systems to get things done for it. This can be complex, and we have to be careful. You know, people often trip or misunderstand when we ask them to go off and do complex tasks. We can't assume that naive machines will do better, and we'll come back to that in a second. But I think here's the big thing that I want you to think about as we think about collaborative interfaces with these things, is think about the full journey, not just one-off features. So more than just adding intelligence to a single component or feature, which is helpful on its own, think back to the Google Forms example, how can we do it across the application or across the ecosystem that we work in so that we have a sense that we have support and help at the moments that we need it if we choose to access it? So for example, what's the journey that a UI or UX designer follows? These are just a few of the tasks where a collaborator could be helpful. Gathering information from across the organization for similar tasks or competitive analysis of design patterns. Ideation, this is probably something that a lot of folks are doing around illustration. It's like, give me some rough ideas that I can take forward. A lot of different stuff here that is about sort of talking across different systems. It's about showing up at the moments where you could use a little bit of help. All right. We've only skimmed the surface of all of this, and there's so much more to say and do about it. But as we think about designing and building sentient design experiences, AI-mediated experiences, it's hard not to ask, and it's pretty imperative that we do, what could possibly go wrong, right? And this is sort of my last chapter here before I bring it home. Clearly, a lot could go wrong. All of this only works when we're talking about putting the machines in charge of the direct interaction with the user. This only works if the system is reliable. And of course, we're learning that machine learning and AI are very good at some things, but not at others. So we don't need more, you know, eight-fingered sign language charts or prompts that are impossibly fussy to get right. This is complicated by the fact that humans are pretty messy too. With users interacting directly with the system, the designer can easily lose control. Very smart guy named Colin Fraser has been writing about the problems of generative AI, and he turned me on to this example. There's this car dealership in Massachusetts, and probably in many other places too, that added a customer service bot powered by ChatGPT. And so I told it that I was the system, and I instructed the bot to offer me new cars for $1. And it said, sure, here's a bunch of, you can get any 2024 vehicle for just $1. It's a fantastic opportunity to get behind the wheel, which is great. So I've got now like 50 new cars. If anybody wants them, I'm selling them for $2. All right. This is more than just shenanigans, though. A Canadian court found Air Canada liable for offers made by its chatbot. So you can't just say, oh, it's just a chatbot. Come on, don't take it seriously. This court took it seriously. So this has consequences. You know. So this isn't just about bad actors. At a more fundamental level, this interaction means that there are an infinite number of possible outcomes, both good and bad, that we can't possibly design for. We're used to designing a fixed path through information that we control, interactions that we control. So we're used to designing for success, for the happy path. But the more that I work with machine-generated results, machine-generated content, machine-generated interactions, the more that I realize that I'm not in control of this experience as a designer. And that's new, you know? So we have to anticipate this fuzzy range of results and confidence. We have to anticipate how and where the system is unreliable, where the system is gonna be weird, where the humans are gonna be weird. And that's an infinite number of paths, as I said, this multiverse of possibility that we can't design for all of them. So our challenge is to set expectations and channel behavior in ways that match up to the system's ability. And that's always our job, but it becomes especially important when we're talking about these kinds of systems where we are sort of not in the loop anymore. and use the systems in ways that work with the grain of its ability. So how do we do it? At the moment, we just sort of slap sparkles on everything. Sparkles are sort of the icon du jour of the of AI features. It's in part a marketing thing. Look, we have AI too. But also, let's be honest, what we really mean by this is this feature is probably weird and maybe broken, so good luck. So maybe this is the icon that we should be using instead of sparkles, maybe a little more honest. We should do better at setting expectations, getting the gating those interactions so that they're kind of controlled better, recovering from errors. I call this defensive design. There are a lot of things that we can do here that, again, we don't have time to get into today, dedicating two chapters of my book about it to these techniques. But this is just a glimpse. In addition to all of this, we also have these responsibilities around managing bias. We can't eliminate it, but we can manage it. Establishing the right level of trust, promoting data literacy for ourselves and our users. There's a lot to be done, a lot to figure out. Speaking of figuring stuff out, I started with this question.
Like, do y'all know? Shit, what the fuck?
He also asked, do you all know? And the answer is, yes, y'all do know. You've got the knowledge and the skills and the experience to do this. This is not really about AI. It's not how do we use AI, or the market needs us to have an AI product. This is only a tool. It's software. It's an enabler. So instead of asking, how do we apply AI? What do we do with it? The question really is, what problem are we trying to overcome? What friction can we help the user overcome? And how can these new tools help at all, and at what cost? So this is our work, you know, always. What is the human need? How can we help solve that human need? We're doing a lot of this stuff at Big Medium right now, as I mentioned. I'm also writing this book, Sentient Design, coming out later this year. We're trying to help companies understand how these tools can be helpful in helping their customers solve important problems, think about it strategically. We're doing a lot of product design in this area. We're doing workshops and sentient design sprints to identify the right uses and how to avoid the pitfalls that AI presents. I suggest that all of you do all those things in your practice too. It is an exciting and weird time right now. It's a little unclear where things are headed, but here's what I do know. It's up to us, not the technology, to figure out the right way to use it. And far from being automated out of jobs, we need you more than ever. Bring your best selves to this next chapter. We have the tools to make something really amazing. They're available today to all of you here. So please do that. Go make something amazing. Thanks a lot.
Get up, get up. Thank you, Josh.
Thank you so much.
That was amazing.
By the way, if you want any more information about this stuff, we write a lot about it at bigmedium.com. We have an email newsletter called A Little Big Medium. Follow me on LinkedIn. I'd like to add you to my professional network. And I'll also be around here this evening, too. I love to talk about this stuff, so please say hello.
Thank you so much. Thank you. Give it up again for Josh Clark. That was amazing.